So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. Isn't spring wonderful? Well, as you all know, like our sitting today is followed by the AGM, Annual General Meeting. And so I thought it would be kind of appropriate to consider who we are as a group, as a Sangha, and what that means, and why maybe our mutual support is so important to each of us. Whether we come occasionally to the Zendo or come regularly to the various mountain rain events. And I was thinking, you know, this is really important or really crucial for us, because in today's society we're so focused on the individual, the I, me, and mine of life, that collectively we tend to be blind. We tend to be blind to the deep importance and nourishment that we get from community. For myself, it wasn't until I lived in Japan as a young man that I really came to understand that our kind of current strong focus on the individual is really only one way of viewing life and of understanding the nature of dignity. In Japan, my friends and acquaintances showed me, by the way that they lived, a kind of larger sense of self, a kind of social self, that while it has its restrictions and, of course, clear boundaries, it also brings ease. It eases that sense of loneliness and that sense of insecurity that plagues so many people here in the West. And for the first time as a young man, I came to see that unlimited personal choice is not freedom. It really is simply a maze of self-doubt and confusion. In the Japanese society at that time, there were kind of circles of community. At least that's how I experienced them, starting with the family being very important. Next, the extended family. And then the next, the family, the school or place of work, then clubs and activities, and then the neighborhood, and etc. There was a sense, a strong sense of, I would say, identity, I guess, with each of those levels that today we don't have so much. Each circle offered a sense of connection and security that was not tenuous. And here are in Canada, our connection beyond immediate family or, you know, really close friends seems so fragile. The connection with community at large, or even with work at times. And sometimes even within the family, it feels pretty fragile, the sense of connection. It's interesting that it's often this very sense of isolation or disconnect that brings people to a community of practice. In Buddhism, this community, of course, is called Sangha. Sangha is one way that we begin to honor the life around us. And what I mean by that is we become aware and conscious of people beyond the family, beyond the immediate circle of school or work. When we take up practice, one way to look at this is that we commit to making ourselves visible. We commit to making ourselves visible, our true self, visible to ourselves, right? Who are you? Who am I? one question, one koan that we sit with. So long are we entangled with our stories about who we are, we have lost that immediate experience of who I am. In Zazen, in our meditation practice, and also off the cushion, we examine our life. And in that examination, we come to accept our humanness. Not as we wish to be, but simply as we are. And as we sit together, you know, in silence, and we talk to each other a little bit, we begin to see and we begin to make visible the other as well. As a practitioner, the unspoken commitment is to keep the truth of who we are visible. And I think as part of a Sangha, the unspoken commitment is to keep the truth of the other visible, to accept the other as part of our kind of collective topography. Sangha helps us to keep all we have become. To keep all that we have become visible, in view. And when we get distracted, Sangha can help us return to that wide view of who we are. You know, we all, I think, understand and know that the practice of Zazen is really quite beautifully simple. We sit, we're quiet. We maybe follow our breath or be aware of our body. Beautifully simple, but not easy. The Buddhist teachings tell us that everything touches everything else. And while there are moments we deeply feel this intimacy, much of the time we're lost in the busyness and preoccupation of daily life. So we come to sit together in the Zendo or in a retreat because the very being with others encourages us to open beyond the sheer fact of things to something a little deeper. Sangha helps us, or perhaps I should say Sangha helps to keep before us what is true, which is so often lost in our daily distractions. Now, traditionally, probably most of you know, one becomes a Buddhist by going for refuge in the three treasures, right? In other words, by saying, usually publicly in some way, I go for refuge in Buddha, I go for refuge in Dharma, I go for refuge in Sangha. And this is part of the Jukai ceremony, as some of you have experienced and know. When a person receives the precepts, it's also part of our monthly fusatsu or full moon ceremony when we chant the bodhisattva precepts on the full moon. And going for refuge in the Buddha came to mean recognizing those qualities the Buddha possessed, like, you know, compassion, concentration, fearlessness, those qualities that are uncontaminated by a kind of self-focus, right? Just compassion, just concentration, fearlessness. And this kind of body of qualities, and there's many more than the ones I just, examples I gave, is what we aim to place our trust in when we talk about taking refuge in Buddha. Those qualities, those we can rely on, rather than my stories about what's wrong with me, or how I should be, or the problems with the person beside me. Now, the word dharma in Sanskrit has several meanings. In the Buddhist tradition, it refers to the actual teachings, of course, left to us by the Buddha and other, it also includes other teachings from of different great teachers throughout time. Now, these teachings, though, are not the truth or holy in the sense of being revealed by a higher power. But they are teachings that point us in the direction of truth, directions of something larger than our everyday experience of who we are. And another meaning of Dharma is truth with a capital T, right? The kind of ultimate nature of who we are and what things are that we can't express in words, but can be lived. The truth of this world and life that goes beyond the stories we tell ourselves about life in the world. And I think this is what may lay at the very foundation of our longing when we start our search for something more than just the materiality of our everyday life. This is what we place our confidence in when we take refuge in Dharma. Sangha. Sangha is the Sanskrit term meaning a gathering or an assembly. A collective can also mean a crowd or a community. Now, it's interesting when I was doing a bit of research on this. Very early Buddhist texts say that to have a sangha of monks or nuns, you needed, this is in India, of course, 10 fully ordained people in an isolated area, or 10 fully ordained people. So we wouldn't qualify. But in an isolated area, you only need 5. And we still don't quite qualify. And I've read, you know, still in much of Asia, Sangha still refers to people who are ordained, the ordained community, and kind of excludes the laity. They're not really included as the official Sangha. And a rationale seems to be, yes, certainly a sympathetic laity is required to support the monks and nuns. But those who are not ordained and living as a monk or a nun full-time have really very limited opportunity to kind of realize the scholarly or contemplative goals of being a Buddhist, of Buddhism. However, you know, in the West today, and I think also in many places in Asia as well, including Japan, Korea, the understanding of Sangha has evolved to represent simply a community of Buddhist followers that's very expansive. It includes, of course, full-time monastics. It includes people who are ordained but are still living and working in the world and not living in a monastery somewhere. It includes lay people who are practicing and working and raising families. It includes also lay people who are spending time in retreats, maybe even weeks and months in retreat. And it includes lay people who just occasionally come to a Buddhist center. So it's all, again, that kind of like concentric circles, right? Rings of mutual inclusion. So this understanding of Sangha is vast, including many different streams of Buddhism, Tibetan, Chan, Zen, Pure Land. So perhaps we could say Sangha is the community of those who follow the Buddhist teaching and constitutes really one vast worldwide community. Now, my sense is that those who begin the practice, come here, mountain rain, they generally can kind of appreciate the Buddha as the founder and exemplar of practice and awakening, right? Kind of like, that's the goal, right? The gold standard. aim for the Buddha. And the teachings are often really a lifeline, bringing great relief and insight. And often the main reason why people come is because they first have heard the teachings or read something somewhere. But the Sangha, well, the Sangha is kind of messy. One wag referred to the three jewels of Buddha Dharma Sangha as the two jewels and a rock. The Sangha really doesn't seem like much of a refuge at first. More often like a nuisance, or even something that's kind of confining and distracting. Today, so many of us are inured to the concept of fellowship that we don't recognize it, nor are we much aware of our need for it. Sangha seems like an add-on. History and experience, however, teach us otherwise. If you remember the story of Prince Siddhartha, as a young man, he was motivated to give up the good life and undertake his quest for awakening upon encountering the four sights. The four sights, right? He saw sickness, he saw old age, and he saw death. And then he saw a wandering Shramana, which means a kind of member of the Indian religious Sangha of wandering ascetics, right? In other words, a wandering monk, right? Taking up various religious practices at that time. So he was part of that Sangha. And it was the encounter with the Shramana, or this monk, that was one of the really igniting sparks, along with seeing, you know, the sick person and the old person and the corpse, that got him on the spiritual journey. Just as meeting the disturbing realities of sickness, old age, and death opened his eyes to the dilemma of human life, so the sight of the monk opened his eyes to the possibility of a response to this very dilemma. So this representative of Sangha did not directly teach Siddhartha anything. As far as I know, they never exchanged a word. But his mere presence was sufficient to help Siddhartha awaken for this longing for an unbounded life. And throughout Buddhist history, Buddhism was understood as being established in a new place, not by the presence of the image of a Buddha, or because there's now a library of Buddhist books, but only when there's a presence of Sangha. As the Buddhist tradition reached India, Tibet, Korea, China, Japan, great emphasis was placed on developing Sangha. It was understood that the teachings, practices, and example needed to be passed on from warm hand to warm hand. Teachers were necessary, sure, and translation and understanding of the sutras was necessary. But the community of like-minded members was perhaps the most necessary, because without it, the Buddhist tradition would die out. One teacher does not a Sangha make. A teacher alone is not enough. A library of Buddhist books alone is not enough either. So Sangha is more than a group of people meeting or hanging out together. I think Sangha, in our sense, implies an intention of interdependence. In other words, after we take up our practice for a little while, we come to admit, to some degree, or at least come to consider the possibility that we cannot and we do not practice alone. And this realization that we don't do it alone is really a radical shift for, I think, most people in the West. Because it's a shift from the independent I, me, mine attitude that's fostered in so many ways in our modern society. It's a shift that, no, I cannot do it alone. And I am not alone. In Sangha, we come to share common intentions, right? To be good people, to be aware and mindful, to deepen our intimacy with our own life. All good. But Sangha involves more than common intentions or identifying with others, like, oh, you agree with me? Right on. Sangha is a community of action, of doing something with others. This doing is really the strength of Sangha, because it becomes then a living event. Sangha becomes a living event. So whether we are sitting in silence, chanting, listening to talks, attending retreats, eating together, sipping tea, at the very center of all those actions, of all action, is a heart of inclusion. In Sangha, we turn toward rather than away from each other. In small and great ways, Sangha teaches us the capacity of the heart. And the more we engage with Sangha, the more we receive inspiration from the basic goodness we encounter all around us. From the people who are manifesting bravery and compassion in their everyday lives. We meet others who are also questioning and suffering and committed to cultivating fearlessness and compassion. Life in Sangha is built on a shared commitment to go beyond self-interest and personal need. This is a medicine that we all really need. Now that sounds pretty rosy. And of course, it's not all that. Often the most unlikely people show up in the Sangha. People who under ordinary circumstances you would never meet and spend evenings, days, weeks, maybe even years together with. As in any gathering of people, there are those who annoy us, those who we get along easily with, and maybe one or two who will become good strong friends. As you may have already experienced, relationships in Sangha are not perfect. In fact, the Sangha at the time of the Buddha was not perfect either. Yet the container of Sangha was strong enough, big enough, for people to take refuge in. Because in the Sangha there were people who had enough compassion, enough solidity, and enough insight to embrace others who didn't have as much compassion, solidity, or insight. In Sangha, we come to share something more fundamental than our own interests and affinities. And in that sharing, the categories of giver, receiver, and gift no longer hold that much meaning. Sangha is the great teacher, holding up a mirror for each of us to look into. So at some point, the sort of person you would avoid at all costs will appear in the Sangha. I guarantee it. There he or she will be, sitting right across from you or right beside you on the cushion in the zendo. And you will have to deal with this person in ways you would never have if left to your own devices. Because your first device would be to avoid them altogether. In this way, Sangha gives us the opportunity to practice patience, kindness, with those very people we would run away from. So it's really good, right, that the Sangha is not perfect, at least in our image, right? That Sangha is not the perfect image of these sweet, kind people who are all enlightened and mm-hmm. ready to just, you can just kind of like sit in and enjoy angel food cake with. A perfect Sangha would not be of much use. And there are times when we expect or ask more emotional or material support from our Sangha, from our community, than we seem to be getting. Disgruntlement will arise, but as we steep in practice, though, I think we come to understand that Sangha gives us such fundamental and healing support. What is that? It's the kind of consistent and gentle encouragement to awaken from the stories of our life. This support that we get from Sangha is pretty, or perhaps I should say at least partly, mysterious. It goes beyond the obvious. You know, the good words maybe you'll hear, the understanding or sympathy, or some good advice you may get from somebody, or encouragement. It goes beyond that. I read in a talk by Norman Fisher, the founding teacher of Mountain Rain, in which he describes the mysterious, silent conversation that goes on at another level in the Zendo, a mutual influencing that happens just by being in each other's presence in silence. He was talking about moments of encounter when we really meet the other with a quiet and open mind. I think this is what Norman has meant at times when he's talked about hanging out. Even if we don't live together in a residential center, we still experience moments of this mysterious encounter, because in our sitting practice, we let go. We become softer around the edges. We open. I read that research shows that we communicate far more with our bodies than we do with our words. Perhaps in our silent sitting, our bows and our chanting, we become less fearful of the intimate, able to receive and perceive deeply the other. The other becomes less and less other. Even those who are weird and annoying become less and less other. When I look back on my own life as a Dharma practitioner, I clearly see that I have always been encouraged and supported by Sangha, by the Dharma friendships that I've formed over the years, but also just by sitting with other people, many, maybe most of whom, you know, I can't even remember their names anymore. Sometimes the Sangha members have helped me through words and actions, and I'm deeply grateful for that. Mostly, however, it's been the shared conviction, however muddled or however unspoken those convictions are, those moments of seeing that, of feeling that, have really sustained me for the past 40 years or so in this practice. So in the end, you know, I don't really have a good definition of Sangha. It's not like joining a gym when you get a card. You can carry around in your wallet. But it's there. It's there when our life is dry and bitter. It's there when our life is traveling at 100 miles an hour. It is that refuge that we hardly realize we need, and yet so desperately we do. We all need to nourish and maintain Sangha, whatever it means to you. You need to nourish it for yourself, for those around you, and for those yet to come. Like all the teachings, it goes from warm hand to warm hand. Thank you.